Clustered around the defendant's table, meanwhile, were roughly 20 attorneys. Lawyers from the Department of Justice and the Department of the Interior were present, as well as a senior advisor to President Barack Obama's Secretary of the Interior, Ken Salazar. Joining the federal team were attorneys representing the states of Idaho and Montana. Nobody from the state of Wyoming was present, since Wyoming's wolves had been excluded from Fish and Wildlife's delisting order. Wyoming Governor Dave Freudenthal was still battling the federal government over the suitability of the state's wolf management plan, and as a result, wolves in Wyoming were still considered an endangered species and couldn't be hunted. Representatives from various ranchers' associations and hunting groups were present as well. Honnold spotted Ed Bangs, the fish and wildlife biologist who had directed the Wolf Recovery Project since 1988, seated with the defendants. He was an unlikely member of the opposition. As the face of the program for 7 years prior to reintroduction, Bangs, who was 59, had arguably done as much as any other person to bring wolves back to the Northern Rockies. Born and raised in a blue-collar California family, he'd spent 13 years as a field biologist in Alaska, where he'd come to know wolves well. He had organized hundreds of community meetings to explain the reintroduction program in venues across the West, often in tiny ranching communities where support for wolves was non-existent. Plain-spoken, self-effacing, and funny, he knew how to talk to his fellow Westerners and had won the grudging admiration of quite a few adversaries over the years. He often began his talks by saying he didn't love wolves, and not just because he'd once been bitten by a yearling in a collaring mishap that left him with a bloody puncture wound clear through his wrist. His commitment to reintroduction was about science, not sentiment. Wolves belonged in the Northern Rockies because they played a vital role in the ecosystem, not because they were beautiful or fun to watch. Now, however, he found himself on the other side of the fight. As far as fish and wildlife was concerned, wolf reintroduction had been a success. It was time for the federal government to turn their welfare over to the states, where wildlife management properly belonged. Honnold and his clients were keeping that from happening, but Bangs didn't take it personally. After the last time Honnold beat Fish and Wildlife in court, Bangs had offered his congratulations. "If I'm ever in trouble," he said, "I want you representing me." For his part, Honnold found Bangs more likable than most bureaucrats, especially the ones he sued, and appreciated his straightforward style. They were both getting close to retirement, and the welfare of wolves had consumed an outsized portion of their careers. For Bangs, delisting would mean wolf recovery in the Northern Rockies was finally complete. For Honnold, one last win for wolves would be the pinnacle of a long and rewarding career. As the defense team's army of attorneys took their seats, Honnold leaned over and caught Bangs' attention. "Do you think you have enough backup, Ed?" he asked, and Bangs gave a tense laugh. The crowd, so rambunctious on the sidewalk, seemed to lose its verve once inside. A nervous silence fell over the courtroom as everyone awaited Judge Malloy's entrance. Honnold had appeared in Malloy's court many times and knew him well. Appointed by President Clinton in 1995, the 64-year-old judge was extremely hard-working, the first to show up at the courthouse in the morning and the last to leave. He read every brief, and he knew the law. His was not the kind of courtroom where an unprepared attorney was likely to escape notice. Malloy was a lifelong Montanan and looked the part, right down to the bushy mustache. Yet he had a reputation for independence, most notably in a series of controversial rulings rejecting timber sales proposed by the U.S. Forest Service, which environmentalists had argued would destroy essential wildlife habitat. He had generally been an ally to wolf advocates. It was Malloy who had shut down Fish and Wildlife's short-lived Wyoming delisting in 2008, balking at the state's management plan with its tepid commitment to maintaining sufficient numbers and its enormous predator zone, in which wolves could be shot at any time for any reason. Fish and Wildlife's unusual response, leaving wolves on the endangered species list in Wyoming while moving forward with delisting in Idaho and Montana, was what had brought everyone to court today. But Malloy's support was far from a sure thing. Honnold had filed his suit immediately after Fish and Wildlife published its delisting rule in the spring of 2009. There was no way the suit would be resolved before the coming fall hunting season, so Honnold had asked the judge for an injunction, forestalling any hunting of wolves until the court had a chance to rule on the merits of the case. Although Malloy had granted a similar injunction in 2008, this time he declined. He conceded that Honnold had a good case, but he disagreed with the attorney's contention that the fall hunt would cause irreparable harm. To the delight of officials in Idaho and Montana, he allowed the first legal hunt in decades to go forward, as each side filed its briefs that winter and prepared for oral arguments the following summer. That decision led to the destruction of Yellowstone's Cottonwood Creek pack, along with the death of 254 other wolves across the region by season's end. Painful as it was to Honnold and his clients, the hunt had at least clarified what was at stake. Malloy was either going to reject Fish and Wildlife's delisting rule a second time, sending the agency and the states away to try once more to come up with a plan that passed legal muster, or he was going to give the rule his blessing, which would mean hundreds more wolves would be killed that fall. The door to Malloy's chambers opened, and the judge strode purposefully to the bench. A former college football star and Navy fighter pilot, Malloy was a big man with a broad forehead, thinning hair, and a scowling mien. In his brief opening remarks, he acknowledged the charged nature of the issue at hand, but dismissed such concerns in his characteristically brusque way. "We are here this morning to argue the legal issues in the case," he began. "They are not normative questions about the goodness or badness of decision-making." He didn't care whether hunting wolves was good public policy. He was just trying to determine whether it was being done in accordance with the law. The judge had given each side just an hour and 20 minutes to make its best case, and the plaintiffs were up first. Honnold spoke quickly and confidently, like a college professor addressing a lecture hall full of undergraduates. "This case is critical to both wolf recovery and the continued viability of the Endangered Species Act," he began. "The truth about Fish and Wildlife's latest delisting rule," he told the court, "was that it was based on politics, not on science. The agency's recovery plan for wolves in the Northern Rockies covered Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana, along with portions of Utah, Washington, and Oregon. Before wolves could be declared recovered and removed from federal protection, the plan stipulated that state officials in Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana, where the vast majority of wolves were found, would have to come up with management plans of their own that would ensure the continued viability of their respective wolf populations. Idaho and Montana had done that to Fish and Wildlife's satisfaction, but Wyoming had yet to comply, choosing instead to sue the federal government rather than amend the plan Malloy had rejected in 2008. Lobbied heavily by ranching and hunting interests, Governor Freudenthal wouldn't budge, which meant that wolves could never be declared fully recovered across the whole region. The result had been a long-running stalemate. The partial delisting was the federal government's attempt at circumventing the impasse, allowing game managers in Idaho and Montana to get control over the wolves in their own states, even as wolves in Wyoming remained on the endangered species list. The problem was that it made no sense from a wildlife management perspective, Honnold argued. If the goal was to ensure the long-term survival of wolves in the Northern Rockies, their numbers had to be stable throughout the region, not just in a portion of it. Fish and Wildlife's logic was legally suspect as well. There was no precedent, he pointed out, for delisting a contiguous population of a species in only a portion of its range. They were all the same wolves, and they moved back and forth across state borders regularly. Maintaining or removing protection according to the wolves' current state of residence was an obvious effort to shoehorn a political solution into a legal framework that wouldn't allow it. In the long history of Fish and Wildlife's implementation of the Endangered Species Act, it had simply never been done. Hanold glanced briefly at Mike Eitel, the Justice Department attorney in charge of the defense team, who looked on in stony silence. Eitel had written the brief explaining the legal rationale behind Fish and Wildlife's decision. It was creative, to say the least, and Hanold looked forward to hearing him defend it in front of Malloy. But the trouble with the agency's management of wolves went much deeper, Hanold continued, all the way back to 1987, when the original recovery plan was completed. According to the plan, the existence of just 100 wolves and 10 breeding pairs in each of the three key states for three consecutive years constituted a recovered population. Wolves in Yellowstone National Park were excluded from the count. This recovery goal was extremely modest, a choice, he argued, that was also driven by politics. "You can go back and read the 1987 recovery plan," Hanold said. "And there is simply no explanation for 300 or the 30 breeding pairs that was selected. None whatsoever. How had the magic number of 300 wolves been arrived at?" he asked the court. "Why not 500, or 1,000, or 2,000? Wolves in the upper Midwest states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota," he reminded the court, "were managed for much higher numbers by Fish and Wildlife. How could it be," he asked the court, "that a recovered population in that part of the country meant 1,200 to 1,400 wolves, while delisting in the northern Rockies, with a much greater expanse of suitable habitat on public land, required only 300. The answer, he suggested, was that 100 wolves per state was the maximum number that officials in Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming had been willing to tolerate when the recovery plan was negotiated. It had nothing to do with science. Of course, all parties had signed off on the numbers in the plan at the time. "Keep your promise," one of the protesters' signs in front of the courthouse had read that morning, a sentiment that was hard to argue against. In the intervening 20 years, however, many wolf advocates had come to consider the terms of the recovery plan a kind of Faustian bargain. In comparison to the modest recovery goals set by Fish and Wildlife, wolf reintroduction was an unqualified success, immensely bolstering the state's case that the time had come to delist. But now that the outstanding quality of the wolf habitat in the region had been established, now that there were at least 1,700 wolves in the region, the numbers in the original agreement were potentially disastrous. The delisting rule required Idaho and Montana to manage for 150 wolves each, as a kind of buffer against reaching the critical 100-wolf level that would trigger a return to federal protection. Even so, under the terms of the recovery plan, over 2/3 of all the wolves currently in the northern Rockies could be legally killed with no repercussions. In any case, Hanold now told the court, it didn't matter what the 1987 recovery plan said. The law required Fish and Wildlife to make delisting decisions based on the best possible science at the time such calls are made. For unknown reasons, Fish and Wildlife was confident that the area could not sustain more than a few hundred wolves, he said. This determination has been disproven by wolves on the ground. Arbitrarily directing each of the three states to manage for the same number of wolves made no sense either, at least from a scientific perspective. 15 years after reintroduction, for example, Idaho now had twice as many wolves as Wyoming, a function, more than anything else, of the outstanding habitat in the central part of the state, which hosts the largest roadless wilderness area in the lower 48. Yet Fish and Wildlife was still hewing to the terms of the original recovery plan, a political deal cut with three reluctant states that seemed predicated more on an agreement to share the pain than on any sound principle of wildlife management. It was time to revisit the plan, Honnold concluded, in light of what had been learned since its inception. None of us wants to go to the doctor who treats us with 20-year-old medical practices, as he put it. Yet as flawed as the recovery plan might have been from the advocate's perspective, it also contained a provision that Honnold hoped might be his ace in the hole. Just reaching the 300-wolf threshold wouldn't be enough to delist the wolf, according to the plan. Evidence of genetic exchange among the three separate wolf populations in the Northern Rockies, Greater Yellowstone, Central Idaho, and Northwestern Montana, would have to be established as well. This meant that Fish and Wildlife needed to document wolves dispersing from one core area to another and breeding in their new homes once they arrived. This interchange was considered critical for the long-term health of wolves in the region. Past research on other isolated populations of large mammals had shown that animals stranded in habitat islands might flourish for a short time, but then began to suffer from the effects of inbreeding and lack of genetic diversity. Moreover, the absence of connectivity among populations might place the viability of any one segment at risk from sudden die-offs through disease or other unforeseen causes. It wasn't enough that wolves were flourishing in Yellowstone or other pockets in the Rockies, Honnold had suggested in his brief for the judge. Projects like wolf recovery were about restoring ecosystems on a grand scale, not, as he now told the court, creating postage stamp replicas of a world long gone. It fell to Molly Knobler, the young Stanford law student on Honnold's team, to make the genetic connectivity argument in court. Though she knew the case well, she was visibly nervous as she stood to begin her remarks, more conscious than Honnold of the Montanans behind her in the gallery, quietly glowering in their Wrangler jeans and hunting jackets. Montana itself could be a little overwhelming for first-time visitors. Landing in Missoula was like stepping back in time to the days of the Old West. This somewhat surreal sensation was exacerbated by the altitude, which often caused a lightheadedness in flatlanders that could last for days. The town was surrounded by the kind of dense forest you seldom saw in the rest of the country, but it wasn't just the thought of what was in the woods that made newcomers feel so unsettled. It was the people, too. You might see a teenager riding horseback down the side of the road, as casual as any kid on a skateboard in Southern California, or come upon a Native American butchering an elk in the back of a pickup alongside the highway. Life here was different. "Can you hear me okay?" Knobler asked the judge, who assured her that he could. Even as the population of wolves in each of the core areas climbed steadily, she explained, biologists had been able to document very little interaction between them. The problem, in part, was the extremely rugged terrain around the borders of Greater Yellowstone. The Beartooth Mountains to the north of the national park, for example, hold some of the most expansive tundra in the lower 48. Wolves ordinarily disperse in the winter, and the Beartooth, at 10 to 12,000 feet, was all but impassable once the heavy snows began to fall, even for an animal as hardy as a wolf. In 12 years of monitoring, Fish and Wildlife had been able to document only two wolves making the trek into Greater Yellowstone from outside the ecosystem. At one point, the service had resorted to trucking in another pair, though as Knobler told the court, describing this as evidence of connectivity strained the definition of the word. As the plaintiffs had pointed out in a brief to Judge Malloy, the existence of densely populated habitat is what forces a dispersing wolf to travel long distances to find a territory of its own. If so few wolves made it from central Idaho or northwestern Montana to Yellowstone when some 1,700 wolves inhabited the northern Rockies, how many would make it post-delisting, when federal protections were removed and the numbers presumably dropped? Fish and Wildlife's own research suggested that a population of around 1,000 wolves across the region was necessary to ensure that connectivity was maintained, yet they proposed to allow the states to manage for a fraction of that number. Even wolves that were inclined to make the journey would find it difficult now that their numbers were being hunted in Montana and Idaho. Under Wyoming's contested state plan, meanwhile, at least some of the wolves dispersing from central Idaho to Yellowstone would likely have to cross the state's free-fire predator zone before they made it to the sanctuary of the national park. If connectivity really was essential to recovery, then how could Fish and Wildlife sign off on such an arrangement? It was a powerful argument, but Honnold noticed that Knobler was having an increasingly difficult time delivering it. 5 minutes into her presentation, she paused. "I'm sorry, Your Honor," she said. "Do you mind if I get a drink of water?" "Are you feeling okay?" Malloy asked. But Knobler didn't reply. She had fainted. Honnold was a California native, but after almost 2 decades in Montana, he was long past culture shock. Still, he understood what pressure could do to a young attorney. He'd felt it too. Nothing compared to the vitriol he'd witnessed in the fight over wolves. Idaho's official wolf management plan, blessed by Fish and Wildlife prior to its 2009 delisting decision, contained the following declaration on the first page. "Idaho is on the record asking the federal government to remove wolves from the state." Idaho's first-term governor, C.L. Butch Otter, a 68-year-old former agribusiness executive, had campaigned in 2006 on a promise of drastically reducing Idaho's wolf population as soon as federal protection was lifted. Though it never became law, the Wyoming state legislature approved a bill shortly before reintroduction that offered a $1,000 bounty to anyone who shot a wolf dispersing from Yellowstone, and directed the state to pay attorney's fees for anyone charged with illegally killing a protected wolf. The fight had spilled far beyond the Rockies. Everybody in the West had an opinion on wolves. Politicians as far away as Texas were taking on the issue. Even the National Rifle Association weighed in, though it had long before ceased to be a hunting rights organization in any real sense. Wolves had become one of those polarizing issues, like abortion or gun control or war in the Middle East, about which the country could not seem to reach a consensus. But the truth was that wolves were just the latest flashpoint in a fight that had been simmering in the West for decades. The real struggle was over public land, what it should be used for, and who should have the right to decide. The federal government owned almost half of all the land in the West, in large part because 19th-century homesteaders found much of it too arid or too rugged to settle, unlike the more hospitable Midwest, which settlers had made into the nation's breadbasket. The government instead adopted a pattern of selling access to the West's rich resources, grazing rights, timber, precious metals, oil and gas, without actually selling the land itself. As a result, the residents of a place like Idaho, where fully 2/3 of the land is federally owned, don't make decisions about how the resources in their own backyards should be used. Instead, agencies like the U.S. Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management call the shots from Washington, and people all over the country, even those who visit a place like Yellowstone or the Grand Canyon only once in their lifetimes, feel that they should have a say in how the West is managed, because it belongs to them just as much as anybody who actually lives there. As the environmental movement gained steam in the 1970s, rising resentment over conservation measures on federal land boiled over in the so-called Sagebrush Rebellion, when Western politicians pressured Congress to turn control over much of the land to the states or even to private owners. Timber companies resented bans on logging in national forests to protect owls and other endangered species. Exhaustive environmental reviews slowed new mining projects for years. For every environmentalist, like Honnold, who resented the fact that cattle were grazed on public lands. There was a rancher in the West who resented paying the fees and believed that the land ought to belong to the people who used it, the sort of common law notion that underlay the very idea of homesteading that had brought people west to begin with. When the effort to wrest control of the West from the federal government failed, some of the frustrated anti-government fervor expressed itself in darker ways, like the white nationalist militia groups that cropped up, most notoriously in Montana. Overreaching federal judges, restrictions on gun ownership, job-killing bans on logging and mining, the list of grievances was long, and the return of the wolf was seen by many as just one more burden to bear. When politicians like Butch Otter gathered votes by vowing to wipe out wolves, they were tapping into that strain of conservative, anti-Washington populism. The anger was real, and from what Honnold had seen, it was getting worse. As his list of victories grew, so did his list of enemies. Death threats had been sent to his office in Bozeman. The off-road vehicle suit Honnold had won had inspired someone, presumably a disgruntled ATV enthusiast, to leave an unlit gasoline bomb on the steps of the local ranger station. A note scrawled on the side read, "Bye-bye, fuckers, boom." The West was caught up in a culture war, and for some people it was more than just a metaphor. And now, to Honnold's dismay, the federal government was turning management of wolves over to state officials who had promised to kill as many of them as possible. But could Governor Otter and his fellow governors really undo what the feds had accomplished? Ed Bangs didn't think so. He didn't share the plaintiffs' concerns over the number of wolves shot by hunters since federal protection had been removed the previous spring. Bangs believed that wolf numbers would rebound quickly. There were simply too many packs in the woods now, producing too many pups every spring, to eliminate them by hunting alone. It would take a return to the brutal methods of the 19th century, widespread poisoning, gassing of dens, government bounties and the like, to significantly reduce their numbers. At most, sport hunting might slow the dispersal of wolves to new territories outside their current range, to areas in the West that were currently devoid of wolves, in other words, by reducing the population density that drove lone wolves farther afield. Privately, Bangs was skeptical that controlling wolves would boost the elk population, which had always been the main rationale for instituting a wolf hunting season. If hunting wasn't sufficient to significantly lower the wolf population in the northern Rockies, then it followed that you couldn't really reduce elk predation that way either. You might be able to temporarily boost elk numbers in certain areas through a brief period of high-intensity hunting, but it wouldn't last. Other wolves would simply move into the unoccupied territory and eat the same number of elk as before. The bottom line, following this reasoning, was that it didn't do any harm, at least at a broad population-wide level, to shoot wolves, but it didn't do any good either. Research in Yellowstone had strongly suggested, meanwhile, that unexploited wolf populations, left to their own devices, would eventually level off on their own, without culling of any kind. When their numbers began to outstrip the available habitat, more wolves would die from conflicts among packs, and breeding females would have smaller litters. Yellowstone's own wolf population, which declined by 43% over a 6-year period, with no human intervention whatsoever, certainly seemed to support the conclusion that wolf populations were essentially self-regulating. Yet Bangs still thought wolf hunting was a good idea. He was convinced that allowing the states to manage their own wolves was the only way to de-escalate the long simmering tensions over the issue, which would be good for the species in the long run. People wanted to shoot wolves, and that was reason enough for a wolf hunt. It might be good for the embattled Endangered Species Act as well, Bangs felt, proving that it could actually work the way it was designed to. His years of talking about wolves with elk hunters and ranchers had given him some insight into how attitudes change. What we normally mean by education he once told a crowd of wolf advocates, is, I want someone else to know what I know so they will have my values. In his experience, it didn't work that way. If wolves were hunted like any other animal, then people would begin to think of them as they did any other species in the woods, rather than as objects of resentment. Hunold wasn't so sure. Plenty of wolves were already being killed on behalf of ranchers, after all, more than most people realized. Beginning with a handful of problem wolves, the pace of the culling had increased as wolves spread and conflicts multiplied. Fish and Wildlife had begun compensating ranchers with confirmed wolf kills, but the money wasn't enough. Officials were under pressure to aggressively control depredating packs. It was not a practice that the federal government was keen to advertise, but taxpayers who knew about the program might have found the logic difficult to swallow. One federal agency was reintroducing predators on public land, a second was leasing adjacent land to ranchers, and a third was dispatching trappers or men in helicopters to kill those same predators when they inevitably crossed paths with livestock. But a deal was a deal, and Fish and Wildlife didn't balk as the numbers killed in the name of livestock protection grew larger and larger. By 2010, more than 1,200 wolves suspected of preying on livestock had been shot. Ranchers might have been appeased, but anti-wolf sentiment in general didn't seem to be tapering off. During the previous fall's hunting season, a handful of hunters had posted gory photos of dead wolves on social media, which had only stoked the controversy further. Hunold also believed that Bangs was wrong to underestimate the determination of state officials to drive down wolf numbers as low as possible, especially in Idaho, which had the region's largest population of wolves. Hunters in Idaho had claimed the majority of the wolves shot during the first legal hunting season the previous fall. After the initial four-month season ended in December, Idaho game officials, in keeping with Governor Otter's promise to kill as many wolves as possible, decided to extend the season until March 31st. A seven-month hunting season is unusual for any species, as is a season that extends into a game animal's breeding period. Some of the wolves killed in March were likely pregnant, which depressed numbers even further. Montana's packs didn't fare much better. The combination of sport hunting and government culling on behalf of ranchers had destroyed more than a quarter of the state's estimated wolf population in a single year. And it was all perfectly legal now that Fish and Wildlife had ceded control to the states. There was even talk of adding a trapping season in Idaho in the near future. Emboldened by the success of efforts in Montana and Idaho, state officials in the upper Midwest, meanwhile, were pressing for a return to wolf hunting there as well. At the same time, Fish and Wildlife was moving forward with a plan to remove protection for gray wolves in the remainder of the country, including areas that currently had no wolves at all. The measure was being pushed by ranching and hunting interests in places like Oregon and Washington State, where dispersing wolves had established a growing presence, and in Colorado as a kind of preemptive measure against their inevitable drift south toward the heart of the Rocky Mountains. Some of Honnold's clients were opposed to any wolf being killed for any reason, though others were open to the idea of limited hunting. But it had to be done responsibly, and Honnold had seen no indication that the states could be trusted on that front. One thing was clear. 15 years after reintroduction, the leading cause of death for wolves in the Northern Rockies was back to what it had been for much of the 19th century, and wolves had as many enemies as they did advocates. Judge Malloy ordered the courtroom cleared so that paramedics could examine Knobler. She soon recovered and declined to be taken to the hospital. The judge directed the bailiff to bring everybody back in, and the proceedings continued after an hour's delay. Deborah Sivas, the Stanford professor, wrapped up Knobler's presentation, and then Mike Eitel, the Justice Department attorney, opened arguments for the defense. Eitel pointed out that while the original Wolf recovery plan might have been 20 years old, as Honnold noted, Fish and Wildlife had vetted its decision to delist much more recently, in 2001 and 2002. As part of that process, the agency had consulted national experts on wolves, the majority of whom agreed that the wolf was recovered in the region and that populations would remain stable under the terms of the delisting rule. But Judge Malloy seemed less interested in the argument over the merits of the recovery goals set by Fish and Wildlife, or whether those goals had been achieved, than in the legal conundrum posed by leaving one of the three states out of the delisting order. Under questioning from the judge, Eitel conceded that Fish and Wildlife had never before split a population along political lines in a delisting rule, though he argued that the Endangered Species Act might be construed to allow it under a novel interpretation of certain key provisions. Malloy listened patiently, but he didn't seem to be buying it. "I still don't understand what the legal argument is that you can subdivide that," he told Eitel. "I mean, I understand the practical argument. I understand the political argument. It's very, very clear, those two things. The legal argument isn't as clear to me, and so that's what's troubling me." Malloy continued to prod Eitel with skeptical questions until the attorney found himself deep in the weeds, parsing the meaning of passages from the congressional record in an effort to establish what legislators had intended in making various amendments to the act over the years. He seemed relieved to hand the proceedings over to Idaho's Assistant Attorney General Stephen W. Strack, a veteran litigator who had argued cases before the U.S. Supreme Court and defended the state of Idaho in several high-profile suits brought by environmental groups. All the talk about minimum recovery levels, Strack suggested, was beside the point. Idaho's Game Commission had created its own state management plan that called for maintaining a population of 500 to 700 wolves. The plan wasn't legally binding, and the state could manage for much lower levels if it so chose, but Strack knew the Endangered Species Act chapter and verse, and he knew that courts were bound to defer to the stated intentions of regulatory bodies. If Fish and Wildlife accepted the numbers in Idaho's plan at face value, then the judge must do so as well. "The plaintiff's suggested methodology is just to speculate that the commission will not carry out its own plans," he argued coolly, gesturing vaguely toward Honnold. "Well, that's simply unacceptable under the statute, Your Honor. That would be arbitrary and capricious, to ignore the commission's own plans." Honnold knew Strack was correct. It didn't matter that the governor of Idaho himself had promised to do everything in his power to drive wolf numbers as low as the state legally could. Strictly speaking, none of that should enter into the judge's calculus in making his decision about the legality of the delisting rule. "So will Idaho maintain greater than 15 breeding pairs, 150 wolves?" Strack summed up. "Well, undoubtedly. We have a management plan that says we will." As the hearing wound down, Malloy queried the representative for Montana's Fish and Game Department about the legality of partial delisting. The attorney turned philosophical. "If Wyoming never came to the table, then what remedy did Idaho and Montana have," he asked the judge, "other than to wait indefinitely in a kind of legal purgatory?" "It's sort of like that figure in Greek mythology who is condemned to roll the boulder up the hill but never had the strength to get to the crest," he said. By noon, the hearing was over. Malloy gave no hint as to which way he would rule, and everyone would have to wait until late summer to hear his findings. As Honnold gathered his things to leave, Ed Bangs caught his eye. "Maybe I didn't have enough backup after all," he said. Honnold smiled, though he knew that neither of them had any idea what the judge was going to do. He had a familiar feeling as he watched Strack and the other attorneys file out of the courtroom, their faces grim. This might have been his last time to stand up and make the case for wolves, but whether he won or lost, it wasn't likely to be the last time wolves were in court. Chapter 7 Iron Man. Rick McIntyre didn't attend the court proceedings. Too much was going on at the den, and he couldn't afford to miss it. 2 days after the hearing, he stood behind his scope on Bob's Knob, with Lori at his side, watching 755 mind his offspring. The pups were 6 weeks old and growing fast, gaining 2 or 3 pounds a week. Everything was still new to them, every novel sight or smell a delight. Though it was mid-June, the weather had turned sharply colder, and sudden flurries forced the watchers back to their cars in search of more layers. Snow in summer was something that Lori was still not quite used to, but the bite in the air had made the pups frisky, and she smiled as she watched one of the pups. At this stage it was hard to tell one from another, screwing up his courage to confront a raven that had landed provocatively nearby. The 2-foot-long, jet-black bird was almost as big as the pup and completely unafraid. There were always a few ravens near the den, hoping to steal a bit of regurgitated food when the pups were fed. They were ubiquitous in Yellowstone, where they filled the ecological niche occupied by vultures in most other parts of the country. The birds spent a lot of time on the ground, down at a pup's eye level, which meant they were among the first creatures in Yellowstone's broad menagerie that young wolves encountered. The Lamar pups had only recently discovered the fun of chasing them. The ravens hopped lightly away, but never went far, which made for a game that could go on for quite some time. It was an early taste of what every adult wolf knew from long and tiresome experience feeding at kills surrounded by hungry ravens. No matter how far you chased them, they always returned. These pups had a lot to learn. After 15 summers in Yellowstone, Rick had a kind of pup primer in his head, a list to tick off as their tiny worlds got bigger and bigger. Pronghorns were too fast to catch, though the pups always tried. Bison were extremely dangerous and best avoided. Coyotes that normally fled from an aggressive pack might turn on a lone wolf, especially if the coyotes had pups in a nearby den. And perhaps the most important lesson of all, strange wolves were not friends. One sunny afternoon, a druid finally found the new family. She was a black female yearling, part of the group that had chased 06 across Little America as she was courting 754 and 755. Rick spotted the solitary traveler at the base of the mountain below the den site, lying in a meadow and chewing on a bone. He could see that she was over the worst of her mange, and her frame had filled out a bit. But she was somewhere she shouldn't have been. 06 inevitably picked up her scent and made her way down the mountainside. Rick braced himself for another violent encounter. 06 stalked through the brush and long grass until the intruder was in range, then ran to confront her, tail held high. The druid female froze. She was face to face with the wolf that had killed Whiteline, her pack leader, only a few months before. The yearling was no match for 06, certainly not with 754 and 755 only a few hundred yards away. But it was too late to run. 06, it turned out, wasn't interested in another fight. As Rick looked on in wonder, she merely sniffed the visitor and allowed her to move on, following her to the east until she was sure that the den wasn't her destination. The lone female wasn't a harbinger of any coming druid revenge, and 06 seemed to know it. The truth was that there were no more druids now, only a few scattered wolves without a pack or a home. Rick was grateful on behalf of the druid female, but more than that, he was gratified to see the kind of leader 06 had become. Good alphas, he felt, modeled wisdom and mercy as 21 had done. Wolves who rose through the ranks merely because they were the largest, or, like the cruel druid alpha female known as 40, the most ruthless, often failed to thrive once they got to the top, and their packs suffered commensurately. 06 could be fierce, to be sure, but Rick was glad to see that she was no 40. Rick knew that in the field of wildlife biology, imputing human characteristics to a creature that it doesn't really have, anthropomorphizing, as the habit is known, is considered a cardinal sin and a hallmark of amateurism. Doug Smith sometimes told people that his wolves weren't Rick's wolves, by which he meant that he was interested in science, not in stories. But wolves, Rick felt, were more like humans than they were given credit for, in their tribal ways and territoriality, in their tendency to mate for life, and in the way male wolves provided food and care for their offspring, so unusual in the animal world. He loved to quote the early 20th century English philosopher Carvath Reed. "Man, in character, is more like a wolf than he is any other animal." When human civilization was still built on hunting rather than agriculture, this notion was considered conventional wisdom. In Of Wolves and Men, Barry Lopez recounts the story of an ethnographer posing a riddle to an elder among the Nunamute, a tribe in northern Alaska. At the end of his life, the researcher asked, "Who knows more about life in Alaska? How to escape a blizzard? How to find caribou? How to survive on such a harsh landscape? A wolf or a man?" "The same," the elder replied. "They know the same." In the weeks that followed, the pups began to wander out of the bowl, exploring the mountainside in groups of two and three. The adults never let them get too far before rounding them up with a howl or a short pursuit. Bears were still wandering through the den area with alarming frequency, and the adults had to be vigilant. By now, O6 had resumed hunting regularly, as one of the brothers, usually 754, watched the pups. She had lost a little weight from her months in the den, but if anything, her lean frame had made her faster than ever. One morning, a crowd on Bob's Knob watched her chase a cow elk and her calf down from the trees east of the den site and into the creek drainage below. The cow was headed for the safety of one of the stream's deeper pools, but O6 managed to get between the calf and its mother just as the pair was approaching the water. The cow was forced to double back, and O6 soon had her by the throat, bringing her down at the water's edge. But the chase wasn't over. As the visitors looked on, the wolf left the cow where she lay and headed back up the bank to track down the calf. In the space of 10 minutes, O6 had killed them both, barely 100 yards from the crowds above. It was not a pleasant thing to watch. Rick always recorded every kill he witnessed in great detail. They were of particular interest to Doug Smith and his fellow researchers, with whom Rick regularly shared his notes. In her own nightly report, Lori was more reticent. She didn't elide such moments, but she didn't dwell on them either. Like Rick, she considered herself an emissary for wolves to the general public, and to her, moments like this, in which the savage side of life in Yellowstone became impossible to ignore, were fraught. More than anything, what wolf advocates fought against was the long-held notion that wolves were nothing more than killing machines. They were so much more, as the wolves of Yellowstone had demonstrated time and again to anyone willing to pay attention. But it was also true that they were among the most effective predators the Earth had ever seen. O6, as Lori frequently pointed out to her readers, was rarely cuddly. But that wasn't why she and so many other watchers had come to admire her. It was her stunning blend of confidence and competence that inspired them, her indomitable will, her ability to bend a harsh landscape to her own ends, to do what needed to be done to provide for herself and her family every day without fail. Seeing her in action was like watching a gifted athlete, like the star shortstop who effortlessly turns every double play, no matter how improbable it seems. Fans know they are supposed to appreciate the overachieving striver who improves through constant practice, the type celebrated in a million Horatio Alger stories. But nobody has to be told to love the natural, for whom excellence seems to be a birthright. The family fed on the pair of carcasses, miraculously unmolested by bears, for 3 straight days. With hundreds of pounds of fresh meat just a short jaunt from the den, O-6 was in almost constant motion, gorging herself at streamside and then making her way, belly wide and low, back up through the long grass to feed the pups at the den high above. By the 3rd day, all 3 adults were meat drunk, O-6 most of all. When the pups tailed after her as she set out at dawn, a would-be hunting expedition turned into a playful romp that ranged all the way down to the creek. Now 3 months old and weighing around 30 pounds, they had become strong runners, though O-6 was still much faster, a fact she demonstrated again and again as the pack made its way leaping and rolling down the grassy hillside. The pups' personalities were beginning to emerge. The one the watchers had begun calling dark gray male was the most adventurous. The other male pup had a lighter gray coat and was more tentative, and Lori had named him Shy Male. There was one in every litter, and Lori tended to worry about them more than the others. The 2 female pups were both gray and somewhat difficult to tell apart, though one was slightly bigger and bolder. The smaller stayed close to her mother whenever possible. At the creek, the pups tumbled off the bank and into the stream, delighted by the icy water. O-6 soon spotted a bull elk grazing by himself in a meadow high above the family, near the den, and began stalking her way uphill as the pups looked on. The bull raised his head, his healthy rack pointing skyward. When he trotted into a stand of nearby trees, O-6 broke into a run. 3 of the pups readily joined in, along with 754. Shy Male held back, watched over by 7:55. The excitement didn't last long. O-6 had merely wanted to test the big bull, and he'd shown no weakness. As first hunts go, it wasn't much of an education for the pups. From O-6's perspective, however, it was a promise of things to come. It had been a long while since she'd had a line of wolves running behind her on a hunt. When it turned cold, it would be time to leave the den and hunt the full range of the pack's territory, the extent of which she had yet to fully explore. She would be mobile again, in a way she hadn't been since the previous winter's trials. Even with the druids gone, there would be dangers, but she wouldn't be facing them alone. As her pack moved by fits and starts back up the mountainside, she could see all 6 of them spread out before her. 7:55, now a willing hunter and equal partner. 7:54, formidable in size if not in disposition. And the 4 pups, still gawky and naive, but growing fast. In just a few more months, they would be almost as big as her, their milk teeth replaced by unbreakable daggers, their legs long, their lungs virtually inexhaustible. This winter, things would be different. Rick religiously recorded every detail of the Lamar's 1st litter in his journal. It was wonderful viewing, though nothing he hadn't seen before at one time or another in the park. This was his 15th summer in Yellowstone, which meant he'd been there for 15 generations of pups, plus another dozen or so from his summers in Denali. The circumstances weren't always so idyllic. He'd witnessed entire litters lost to disease, pups killed by mountain lions or bears, dens raided by marauding enemy packs. Starvation, usually following an injury or death in the pack's alpha pair, was the worst to witness. To the more dedicated watchers who returned time and again, Rick was a guru. He seemed to know every last detail about every wolf he spotted, their lineage, their life history, their quirks and habits. Part of his appeal was his presentation. His soothing, mellow voice was easy to listen to, and his flat affect was almost mesmerizing, especially in the bucolic roadside settings of Yellowstone. His reputation had grown beyond the park as well. The yellow Nissan X-Terra he drove had been donated to the Park Service specifically for his use after a Nissan employee became a regular visitor and wolf watcher. So had his spotting scope, a top-of-the-line model from Swarovski, the high-end Austrian manufacturer which sold for thousands of dollars. Doug McLaughlin had set that up. As word spread about Yellowstone's wolves, he sold more and more scopes until finally he was among the top Swarovski salesmen in the country. One day, Doug called his contact at the company and pointed out that Rick McIntyre, the man who had seen more wolves than anyone else on the planet and who spent his days engaging countless ecotourists and would-be Swarovski customers, was using a run-of-the-mill Bushnell. It was a question of marketing. If Swarovski was the Nike of spotting scopes, then why wasn't the Michael Jordan of wolf-watching using one? The company arranged for Rick to get a new scope and extended an open-ended offer to send him the latest models when they were released. Rick was happy to have the scope, but he had never taken the company up on that upgrade. He liked the one he had. As a rule, he wasn't big on change. His daily diet, for example, almost never varied. Frozen blueberry bagels and Diet Pepsi featured prominently. His spaghetti recipe was once featured in a celebrity cookbook, the sales of which benefited wolf research. Rick's dish, which he made with a modest amount of ground bison meat and ragu sauce, was considerably simpler than Linda McCartney's recipe for aubergine caponata, which appeared on the opposite page. But then again, it had to be. He ate it almost every night. Laurie and Doug did most of Rick's shopping for him, since he rarely made it into a town big enough to have a real grocery store. Laurie had gradually been introducing some vegetables into his diet. Rick had come to depend on Laurie in more ways than one. Even as he grew more adept at talking to visitors, he remained a little rough around the edges. One day, after he abruptly cut someone off mid-question, Laurie approached him. "Rick, you just can't talk to people that way," she said. He was chagrined and grateful to her for pulling him aside. He started seeking Laurie's advice whenever social situations turned sour. Rick had long compared Doug Smith to 21, his favorite wolf. Eventually, he began telling people that of all the women he'd met, Laurie was the most like 42, 21's longtime mate. Of course, Laurie already had a mate of her own, and so did Smith, for that matter, but she understood what he meant. As for Rick, his own relationships never seemed to go anywhere. He had dated a woman, a wolf watcher who came to the park frequently a few years after he moved to Silvergate permanently. One morning, she suggested the two of them go to Bozeman to see the new Johnny Cash movie. Rick was amenable, though he was thinking, "Provided we see a wolf before it's time to start driving to Bozeman." Rick happened to be in the midst of his longest streak of wolf sightings, a stretch that eventually extended to 891 consecutive days. That morning, the wolves had proved difficult to find, and as the day wore on without a sighting, he became more and more anxious. He finally decided he was going to have to tell her he couldn't go, when a friend suddenly got a wolf in his scope and hurriedly called Rick over. Disaster was averted for the time being, but the relationship eventually withered. The wolves always came first. They were his family. The more Rick learned about Yellowstone's wolves, the more responsibility he felt to tell their story. He had come to think of his writing project as not just a single book, but a series of books, covering everything from the rise of the Druids to the arrival of 06. But when was the first book going to appear? It had been 15 years since he'd published anything. He had a mountain of material from his daily observations in the park, enough for an entire shelf of books. His journal contained 13 years' worth of notes on the Druids alone, and the story was fantastic. And yet he hadn't begun writing any of it. He worried that he couldn't meet the high standard he had set for himself to become the next Ernest Thompson Seton. But something else was holding him back, too. Once the first book was finished, he'd have to promote it, which meant he'd have to leave Yellowstone and go back out into the world. He'd have to stop spending time with the wolves and become their emissary, just as Jane Goodall had done when she tore herself away from her beloved chimps to begin her own writing and speaking career, championing their cause everywhere she went. Instead of quiet mornings in the park, there would be airports and traffic and hotels. After 15 years in the same place, doing the same thing day after day, it was all a little hard to imagine. So, instead, he continued to collect material, a little more every day, making the mountain higher. Some of what he recorded made for gripping reading, though for every engrossing account of a wolf like O-6 fighting off a bear or taking down an elk, there were pages and pages describing sedentary wolves engaged in the same mundane behaviors you might observe while watching a dog whiling away empty afternoon hours on a back porch. Standing, facing west, sniffing the ground, sitting back down. When Doug Smith and his team began a research project, they were always trying to answer a specific question, the relationship between wolves and ravens, for example, and this gave their note-taking some direction. But Rick wrote down everything. Back in Denali, where he'd spent all his free time taking pictures of wolves and other wildlife, he had grown so obsessed with getting the perfect shot that he found himself encroaching on animals, entering their space in ways that bordered on harassment. "You learned to rationalize it," he would later tell friends. "It was part of being a professional wildlife photographer. Somebody else was inevitably doing something worse than you were, and there were always boundaries you wouldn't cross. Until you did." He began to feel a kind of helplessness in the face of his compulsion, like an alcoholic